Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Ki Tavo, which was the Deuteronomy 26 through Deuteronomy 29, verse 8. Obviously, covers a lot of blessings and cursings. Some actually more cursings than blessings by a long shot. I didn't do the ratio, the count of which to which, but I said probably like three times more cursings than our blessings there. But that's okay. Which one of the reasons why they, to the Haftor portion is Isaiah 60 to make you, end on a happier note, because these are pretty hard, unpleasant notes. The whole idea of eating your children and such is rather disgusting and abhorrent in so many ways. Before I go to my spiel or topic, talk about these topics and these discussions regarding this Torah portion as well as the Haftor portion, any comments you have regarding this or any questions you have regarding this Torah portion we just read? Obviously, I realize it's somewhat gross in many topics and many discussions, but hey, he's our God. He made all this stuff, gross or otherwise. Any questions or comments, unmute yourself and ask. Otherwise, I'm going to move on to my spiel.
Go ahead.
Louise here. I agree. The curses that they verbalize, I don't even want to repeat them, are horrendous.
They are.
Is this what David meant when he went out against Goliath? Or what Goliath tried to use against David? When he said, I'll cut you up and feed you to the beasts of the field and the birds of the air? Or is that just a general curse that was popular in that time era?
That's a good question. I believe that is a general curse that's popular throughout the entire Tanakh. It's used obviously here in a Torah portion. Used again, as you correctly referenced, for David and Goliath. It's repeated again in the Book of Revelation. I believe it is a phrase, obviously, that you could be wasted away, nothing left for you to bury, because you'd just be nothing but scattered bits and pieces, and that there will be no one. This is no funeral. There's no place. They can't say, I'm sorry, so and so died. And like nothing like that. It won't exist, because that is the ultimate disgrace, is to die and have no remains. To have no remains in Jewish thought means, how do you get resurrected? Because mind you, remember, Jewish philosophy is you're resurrected in the body you see. It's what you look like this. Well, not my hand, but you look like your own body. you are your own presence. You appear as you look now. That is their philosophy. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. It just is. And so if there is no body to resurrect, then there's nothing to return to. And hence the idea of do not leave a body unburied and do not be burned into ashes. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. I'm just saying this is their philosophy. Don't burn to ash, because if there's nothing there to return to, then you can't be resurrected. That's the theological, symbolic theory, theology. I can't say it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's what their theology is. So if you are scattered and the birds and the animals devour you, like, for example, Jezebel, the idea is that you would not be resurrectable. Nothing left of you can be brought back. As opposed to being buried, then you'd be resurrected at wherever you were buried, whether it's in some cave or ground somewhere on earth. You pop back up again when God says, rise. So that's their idea. And there is some fair legitimacy to it. And I use fair legitimacies because, for example, let's go back in time. Imagine for a moment that Lazarus, when he died, was cremated. So when Jesus comes and says, okay, remove the rock, what comes out? dust. Also, in other examples, when you have the individuals that are resurrected as well, and in our Bibles discuss the topics when I believe it's a soldier, I think there's a soldier who was killed and cast into, I think it was Elisha's tomb. He sprang back alive again. Well, again, if he's not a body, if there's nothing there to throw to cast in the tomb, he doesn't spring back as a flesh and blood human anymore. And so that's, so they didn't come up with their theory off the top of their head because they were bored one day or drank too much wine. They came up with the theory because they had the context of examples. Okay, well, every example of resurrection, example, you're brought back in the form that you looked like when you died. And that was the idea behind it. And so that's the, and granted, there are very few examples, but the few examples they have, that's what it is. And so the idea of scattering your ashes or being cremated in general or having the body be lost is a foreign idea. You don't do that. And this is not the reason, however, but that same philosophy still binds itself to our modern day Marines. Leave no man left behind, even if he's a dead body. Don't leave him behind. They don't do it for the same reasons at all. There's nothing to do with the reasoning. But the philosophy, you don't leave even the dead remains, must be returned to a place where it can be buried properly with respect. They don't do it for the same reasons, but the philosophy, the idea is still there, that you value even the dead corpse that's there, that it be brought back. I'm not saying they're right or wrong on the philosophy. I'm just saying that's where their philosophy comes from, and it has some legitimate proof in that there seems to be, I can't think of any proof anywhere in our text that has the opposite being the case, meaning someone who is scattered into bits or burnt into ashes is brought back in any example. So they have no evidence our text otherwise, I can tell.
Well, in Ezekiel, it's obviously a vision that he had, but there was the scattered dry bones that he was told to talk to. And right. Then they grew sinew and flesh and muscles and...
Right. And in that example, exact example, all the bones, they're all there. They're all physically there. The objects are all there in present. And obviously when you pass away, only your bones, the ones, not your flesh survives. Only the, survive the right word, last. So in his example, yeah, you're right. It's a vision. The example also uses the same citation of Jewish philosophy of you have to have some structure that exists to be resurrected. Now, I'm not saying that's correct. Just saying that that is their philosophy. Don, your hand is up. Go ahead, Don.
And I can't give you the citation, but the chapter and verse. But it says that in the end, the sea will give up its dead.
Right.
And and obviously there's been plenty of
ships gone down. A lot of people have perished.
So forth. We can't imagine that there'll be a whole lot left of them either.
Probably not.
But so there's some idea that in the end something will be there. But again, you're
whatever that is. Yeah,
not a lot left of anybody after.
That's not much time. And to be fair, our bones eventually become dirt too. They don't unless they're fossilized. They eventually decompose too. So again, it's a philosophy. It's kind of a strange. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. Just different. Different in versus a Christian or a Greek philosophy. In that your body is an immaterial object. So there's just different ways of looking at it. It could be a citation of, all these people who drowned, theoretically speaking, I'm not saying this is the case for all of them. Theoretically speaking, they drowned and then their body, it went down as a whole unit. Obviously, sharks ate bits and pieces and crabs tore it apart and everything else ate the thing and ate it and disintegrated it into bits. And I'm sure that's the case for all those various bodies, at least with very few exceptions. But the idea though, in that Judaism works on things you can see and things you can actually touch and feel, real tangible objects, as opposed to the Greek philosophy, which uses things you can think about and things you can't see, but can contemplate with inside your head. They have two different ways of looking at life in general and miracles. Everything else is always very physical with regard to Jewish philosophy or Hebrew philosophy versus very spiritual or mental, more accurately mental. when it comes to Greek philosophies. Two very, very different philosophies. So in Judaism, if it's not physical, it might as well not be there. So when something drowns, it's a physical object that is there, and then it's not. It went as a whole unit. So they view it as a whole unit went down, therefore a whole unit comes back up. It's because very physical and very tangible things. And so all their viewpoint, you look at the Torah, Tanakh, anywhere, it's based on physical, real things you can touch or feel. Because again, God created all this stuff as real physical stuff. Yes, Jeff.
Well, the interesting thing we see in this passage itself, when it's talking about these pillars, these monuments that are set up related to these two mountains that are being talked about, that's a physical representation. And you see like the memorial stones put next to the Ardennes crossing. These are things that people can look back to, even though the event's long since gone. You can look to something physical and say, okay, this is a reminder of something that went before. And you can even see that with Jerusalem in itself. You know, either it was during the exiles or now during our current exile of a sort, you can look to and look back to the place. These are like the bones of the temple. The bones of the temple sitting there, they're like, okay, one day those bones will be revived. And the king will come into his temple yet again. But until that time, you sort of have the hope of like the Temple Mount being the grave of the temple. And right. One day it will be resurrected.
Good example. That's a very good example. And to say that is, again, when you're looking at thinking Jewish or thinking Semitic or that viewpoint, because again, the Bible was given to them on purpose, not by accident. It is a very physical thing. And so every promise, every example must be physically true, not just or not only spiritually true. So something, if it's spiritually true, but not physically true, it's not real. As far as Jewish philosophy, you can't have something that is spiritually true and physically untrue. It's not, doesn't work. It's not possible to make that happen. So if you have a temple being resurrected, as Jeff pointed out, the structure must already be there in order for, or something to be, or to be resurrected. And it cannot be a spiritual example. It must be a physical thing too. Again, because they are physical in their philosophy and viewpoint, and in your Tanakh, your entire Torah in Tanakh, as well as the New Testament too, depending on how you view it, is very physical. Every example, every promise, every citation of a covenant must be fulfilled in a physical manner. And then separate from that, the spiritual matter can go with it. But you cannot have in Jewish philosophy or Jewish viewpoint a spiritual fulfillment and not have a physical one. If you have that, you have a disconnect. You no longer have God in charge of his creation. The creation is now separated from the spiritual world. And if you separate heaven from earth, they don't work correctly. They have to keep them attached together. So their philosophy, when they're looking at something, if it's not physically true, then it cannot be spiritually true, because then creation and heaven no longer are coupled together. They then divide it up. When they divide it up, all hands are off. Now it doesn't mean anything anymore. You can't relate or understand it. Yes, Jeff.
And one interesting point to... as an entry point to talk with people who are questioning or even antithetical to the Bible, is that there's a growing number of secular scientists, including physicists, who are understanding that underneath matter is what you would call information, that information is key, that which is not, we would call it spiritual, the things that are not material is the underpinning to the things of matter. And, you know, they've seen it in the, one of the things that's been baffling is, why is every single particle, wave, et cetera, absolutely identical? It's a digital world. It's not an analog world where the variance is here, there's and that and the other. They have very set things. They come into existence with that. You know, you can measure them at this. So it's like, well, there seems to be something spiritual, immaterial, totally information-based underneath it, that which is material. So that's when you see these things throughout the Tanakh and throughout the apostolic writings about, you know, that which is spiritual is real, not just that which you can touch being real. Even the secular world now is coming around to that realization. Yeah, that is what looks like what reality is.
Strange. Hadn't thought about that one. That's a new, you know, new way of looking at things. I'm not familiar with that world of science in that capacity. Any other comments or questions? Oh, so they had their comment up?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and go ahead.
Okay, so in, was the Corinthians or one of the New Testament books, they're sown a seed, our bodies, our flesh is sown a seed into the ground, it dies, and then it comes up another thing. Like an apple seed goes in, and it comes up looking like an apple tree.
Correct.
Looking like the seed it started with. So it perished, it died, and it became dust and everything. But like Jeff just said, the inner DNA instruction, whatever was in there, is still alive, whether it looked at it or not. It came up a resurrected being. Something entirely looking different, although maybe we'll know each other when we get there. I don't know. It could be we won't remember anything from this world. It's a test. So that's my point. I don't know. Maybe I didn't come across the same way as Jeff had a definite thing about analogs and stuff. I kind of went over my head a bit and out the door.
No, that's okay. No, it's there are a lot of many ways of looking at real objects and looking at the world around you.
When it comes to that spiritual and physical thing that you were talking about, Daniel, about, you know, the Jewish mindset or whatever, that it cannot be, they cannot be separated. They have to be attached somehow.
Right.
So are they looking at that point of sown a seed, a certain looking like a seed, a peach seed in the ground, and then it turns up to be something other than what it looked like? That
example is dominantly a comes out of our New Testament citations, obviously. However, since all New Testament authors and writers and philosophers are written in it, we're all Jewish. They all approach, and when we read their texts, we have to remember that they were born, raised, and taught to be Jews, and so they understand things in a Jewish context and Jewish viewpoint, including the words choice they use are Jewish word choices. So when we discuss or talk about their examples, they are Jewish examples and Jewish philosophies, not Greek ones. I'm not saying there aren't Greek examples within inside of our New Testament. The point is the men themselves were Jews, and so they thought and taught as Jews. So we read their text, you have to read their words as a Jew would read their words. It's actually, it is maybe very subtle in some people's viewpoints as far as whether or not you approach their writings from a Jewish viewpoint or not. But to me, it is somewhat important. If I cannot understand the thought process of the author, I can infer my own word definition on the words they chose. Actually, a topic my wife and I were discussing last night regarding this topic, regarding someone can use a particular English word in multiple ways correctly, but it be interpreted extremely different depending on what you as a listener infers that word to mean. So I can choose, I know this is a political example, so forgive me for those of you, I don't usually go into too many politics, but the term loser, which has been brought up in our media recently, there is the definition of the slang term loser as someone who is worthless, and the other definition of someone who actually just plain lost. There's the winner and there's the loser. And I, as a hearer, can interpret what the speaker is saying. I can apply a definition of win versus lost, or I can apply the definition of someone or something that is worthless in overall. And that citation was brought up recently due to some various words being used in our political context. And that, for example, one of the citations was that a bunch of men dead at a gravesite, and cited that they were all losers. Absolutely. That is correct. All these soldiers who perished in a battle are the losers. The winners, the ones who went home alive. It's not about who's the best, who's the worst, who's worthless, who is not. No, it's about who actually lost something. The losers in a battle are the ones that die. The winners are about the ones that go home alive. And not regarding which side wins, which one's right or wrong. It's you lost the most because you're dead. Therefore, you lose the battle. It doesn't matter whether you are a good person or a bad person. It doesn't matter if you're a hero or a deserter. It doesn't matter if you're a traitor or the commander. If you're dead, you're the one who lost. You are the one who really is the loser of the battle or the loser of the war because you died. It has nothing to do with whether you're a good person or a bad person. So you can use the term in a slang form or a legitimate definition form, and the hearer can interpret the results. So if I read the New Testament in a Greek philosophy, I can apply a Greek interpretation of it and get a false or an incorrect viewpoint. First, I use the Hebrew definition. I get the Hebrew mind, because the person who wrote it was Hebrew or Jewish. I get their definition, their viewpoint. Now I have a correct understanding of the word or phrase or argument. And so it's really important in my mind to note the difference of the author. I do realize some may argue it is subtle and not necessarily important in the grand scheme of things. And that may be true. That may be a fair argument. That is just not where I stand. So when it comes to text or words being used, when it comes to the philosophy of a Jewish philosophy versus a Greek philosophy, or any other kind of philosophy, it's important to understand who is writing, who is speaking, who is telling, and who is the audience, who's the listener. Because the speaker, in some instances, may know their audience well enough to say, okay, I'm going to speak in terms that you comprehend versus ones that I comprehend. But that's important to understand. So when I go through the Torah, I look at, okay, Hebrew viewpoint, Hebrew mindset, these are physical, real things. These curses really actually happen. Like, literally, men eat their children, women eat their children, and guess what? It's true. We read through it to Tanakh. Guess what? It did happen. They did do that. So they are real curses, real events, and as a result, then they are real blessings too. Real tangible stuff you can grab a hold of and have as a yes, here it is. So to me, it's important to understand that our Tanakh, or Torah in particular, Tanakh is written in a Hebrew mindset. So these are real things. They may be grotesque to us, hard to think about, don't even speak about them, awful words, awful thoughts, but they are real, which means they are true. And being true, God knows who he's talking about. He's explaining exactly what really is going to occur. So I hope that makes sense. Any comments, questions before I go to my spiel? Too deep into my spiel. My time's still doing okay, I think. All right, so let's jump through this real quick. There's certain components I want to talk about. And we start out in chapter 26 of Deuteronomy. It begins in the principle of first fruits, of the things which you grow. And of course, starts out obviously of the land that you produce. So this is obviously including clearly fruits, vegetables, grains, things of that nature, which you offer to God. What I want to bring your attention to is the actual words being spoken by the individual bringing it up. So it was thought out a little bit in verse 3. This is, again, a subtle thing, but to pay attention to because it matters. In verse 3:26, it starts out, you shall come. When you are bringing this stuff, these first fruits, you should come to whoever will be the Kohen or the priest those days. You should say to him, I declare today to Yehovah, your God, that I have come to the land that Yehovah swore our fathers to give to us. Now, he is coming. Note his phrase, your God, instead of my God or our God. Now, we may think that, oh, well, that's kind of strange. Why do you say your God versus mine? Do you not worship the same God? Do you not obviously all go and believe the same thing? You worship the same stuff, yada, yada, yada. Why, he wouldn't even be going to the priest if he didn't worship the same God. It has nothing to do with that. Has nothing to do with whether or not you worship that God or don't worship that God. That's not relevant. That's immaterial to the conversation. What matters to conversation is, what is the man or woman, in this case a man, citing when he says to the priest, your God? There is a relationship going on as far as how a structure works. You will note throughout your Tanakh, when a foreign individual, such as a Gentile nation or Gentile king, makes any reference to a king of Israel, he refers to, in reference to a God, it is your God. So King Gentile Nation A talks to King of Israel, says, your God, referring to the King of Israel's God. When you're talking to a prophet, you as an individual, you refer to the prophet as you and your God. What it's doing is it's showing the relationship that this individual you're speaking to, the prophet or the king of the priest, is the person in front of you who is the representative of that particular God. Does that make sense? So you are not referring that you don't believe in that God or you don't follow the same God. You refer that you, priest or prophet or king, are the one here on earth established by your God or by our God to be his representative in this matter. Whether it be a judgment for like your king, you're going for a trial court, whether it be a high priest, in this case for the offerings, the first fruits, or be a prophet that you need help from a prophet and you're paying, hey, here's an animal or whatever it is, like some of the prophets we've received for blessings and such. It was referred to as your God. It shows a respect or an identity that you are realize that this person is a representation of God on earth to me in this situation. Now let's flip those tables a little bit. Let's pretend you are an Israelite. Let's go back and you live in Israel. You're an Israelite now, right? Imagine you got, you know, whatever going around you back in this time in history. So we'll say there's caravans going around. There's, you know, the dust, the smell, the yell and the screaming of, you know, the vendors in the side streets, all going about you. A Gentile who is not of Israel, but is speaking to you, will say, refer to you and your God. Now, in that relationship, you being the Israelite, the relationship to the Gentile who is not Israelite, the non-Gentile is referring to you as the Israelite as representative of your God here in this conversation. That relationship is then transferred also between from the Gentile to the Israelite to also over here, the Israelite to the high priest. The relationship is made the same. The relationship is maintained the same all the way through, regardless of who you're speaking to, whether it be king to subject, prophet to king. Some instances, a prophet, the king may say to the prophet, "You are." He fell down. You are the representative of God here, because the king may speak to a prophet in that way. It's the relationship that matters. It's identifying relationship that you are the representative of it. So all that say, you and I are also representatives of our God to everyone around us. And so that comes with a specific responsibility to be a good representative, to be that good example that you represent your God correctly or as best you can. There will be times that you are subordinate and someone else is a better representative than you are. Therefore, you defer to them. But there are times that you are a representative and therefore others will defer to you. So it's important we understand the relationship, that there are others that are greater than us, others that are less than us. And wherever we are on that scale, it doesn't make any difference. Higher, lower, in the middle, near the tail, near the head, makes a difference. There are some that are greater than you and you should defer to them. There's some that are lower than you and you show honor, an example of respect to what their needs are, as they should defer to you. So it's important that we do wherever we are at, do we show the deference properly and show the respect properly, up or down or sideways makes a difference. But is that we try to represent our God in the best way we can in the place that we are at. Because they're where you are, someone's always watching. Someone above you may be watching, someone below you may be watching, someone sideways you may be watching. You're always watching. It's important to be there and be that relationship understood. Let's move forward a little bit. This storyline, and going into this individual who's bringing his first fruits, jump down to verse 5. You shall call it and say, before Yahweh your God, this is for the individual who brought forth his first fruits, his offering to God at its timing. An Aramean, mind you, my Bible will word this one way. Yours might word it differently. And it's nothing, not material necessarily to the event. It says, an Aramean tried to destroy my forefather. He descended to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation, great, strong, and numerous. Stop. So in this case, he's citing an example of an Aramean, his father, this reference to Jacob, of course, tried to destroy his father as far as being brought down to destruction or defeated. Now, your Bibles might read, an Aramean, my father was a wandering Aramean. It doesn't really matter how your English translation words this phrase. Both are still legitimate in the context being cited. The term wandering Aramean, wandering can mean wandering. It can also mean destroy or destruction. So it makes very little difference how way you wish to read it. The point is, if you as individual are at the point of either wandering and you have nothing because you are wandering with the clothes on your back that you've got, or you are at the point of being nearly destroyed because you're about to be wiped out, those are two positions that are very, very low. And they're about as low as you get, shy of actual death itself. You're homeless with nothing, or you have stuff, but you're about to be wiped out and you won't survive anyway. And neither of those positions are enviable. They are places that are very low, and they're low on purpose. The contrast here, what we're doing here, what this person is doing here, they're trying to declare the example of where they started out as being very, very low and how that God has blessed them to be very high or well off in what they are doing, hence the first fruits. So a citation is declaration of comparison. Where did I start from and where am I now? That's the contrast, where I came from and where I am. Now I have a question. Don't answer this question, but think about it to your own heads. Spend time in your life and say, wait a minute, where am I now? And what did I start with? Way back when? When I was first out of my parents' household or first off of my, okay, now I'm going to hit the words of the world. Here I am. What did I start with and where did I end up? And I look back at my life. Okay, well, where was it last year? Where was I 10 years ago? 30 years ago? 40 years ago? What was life like? How have I moved forward? Have I moved forward? But the point is to contrast and value where you're at, the blessings you've got. Theoretically, they are blessings. You've grown. And how did you get there? See, it's very valuable in this instance. For this individual, first fruit would do this every single year. Or actually more accurately, every season. Because you have first fruits for different crops throughout the year. So every season, you have the opportunity to stop for a minute. I receive these fruit, whatever it may be, whether it be animals, whether it be vegetables or whatever it might be. Well, okay, I got these. How did I get here? How did this blessing come to me? Let's go way back and review my entire family history, where I came from, and how we got from there, the lowest place you can be, all the way up to where I have a home, I have a family, I have land, I have produce, I have everything that I've ever needed, but I have security, so to speak, and contrast that. That shows an intense or invokes intense sense of gratefulness and where it came from. God seems to really enjoy or like gratefulness. It appears to be a fairly consistent theme, being grateful for what you have and where you are and where you came from. Most of us start off this world with very, very little. I'm not saying everyone does. Most do. And what do you make of it? Where did you grow? How did you move forward with it? How did you get blessed from now? And particularly the older you get, the more of a background you can look back and see, where did I come from? And how did I get here? Not just me alone, but my family, my children, my grandchildren. How did they get where they're at? Now, they didn't exist when I was a young child. They didn't exist, like, obviously, because they weren't around. But you examine and review the blessings you received on a semi-regular basis to look back and say, yes, God is working with me. He does have handiwork. This process is moving forward. Those are good things. So that's a great example. It says, obviously, Hebrews our nation, Shema verse 6, the Egyptians mistreated us and afflicted us, placed hard work on us. We cried out to Yehovah, our God, our forefathers. Yehovah heard our voice, saw our affliction, our travail and oppression, took us out of Egypt with a strong hand, with outstretched arm, with great awesomeness, with signs and wonders. He brought us this place. He gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now behold, I brought the first fruit of the ground that you have given to me, O Yehovah. And this is the declaration of what God has done. So you went through this process of where we started out, we grew, we went through a major trial in the process. By you, in case you haven't noticed, most of us go through some very difficult times in our lives. Major trials, difficult times in our lives. Okay, and I came out the other side, and here I am now, formed and created by all those trials and sequences that I got here. Bottom line, most of us are a compilation of all the path we went through to get where we are today. For the blessings from God, the poor choices, the good choices, the examples we did or didn't do, and we ended up where we are. And this is where we're at. The point is to, in the first fruits example, which is supposed to offer every time you have a first fruit of whatever the land produces, whatever the species might be, is you get a chance to review and look back. How did I get here from just last year or just 10 years ago? And we're in that trial 4 years ago, that this miserable thing I was going through, and look, I made it out the other side. That to review it on a regular basis. And the idea is that, and it says, behold, you have given me. Now, the verse 10 says, now, behold, I have brought the first of the land that you have given me, O Yehovah. Now, it does not say that the man didn't work for it. Unless he didn't strive and difficulties and had to battle the disease and the aphids just wouldn't go away. He had to spray the aphids again and again and again. Yeah, there's blood, sweat, and tears, sure. But it's still a blessing God gave it to you. Because we learn the cursings, he could have easily just stopped sending you water. And guess what? You got nothing. You might eat the aphids. That's how you gotta live on. Not saying you should eat the aphids. The point is that you have nothing. Even though you did all this work, reality is the work you put in is still a blessing from God that it came about, that something was produced by it. You can put a lot of work in a vineyard, but as he points out, when worms eat it, doesn't matter how much work you did, the vineyard's empty anyway. It's dead. It's gone. So the work alone doesn't do it. It requires a blessing from God to make it succeed. So the point is that to review it. And verse 11, you should rejoice all the goodness your God has given you, you, your household, you and the Levite, the proselyte who is within your midst. So you enjoy the blessing God's given you. It's good to be blessed and also enjoy the blessing. So again, set it before the priest, the opportunity is to review where you came from and where you were at and how this thing's happened. It gives us perspective on how our lives have changed over time. And over the years, and how we have influenced one another, and how our lives have been influenced by God. It helps examine our progress and our blessings. So, in this, and also verse 12 points out, when you finish the tithing of a year, your produce, tithe, Levite, proselyte, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to go through all this whole story in your cities and such. You are not doing this process in a vacuum or in a bubble. This is done with others. Now, I admit, I'm a very private person. Yeah, I rattle off the mouth, as my wife said, vomit at the mouth. I tell a lot of stories and I can't stop talking. But my personal life generally is relatively private. I don't keep my trials. I don't spread them out. And this is miserable and you all need to commiserate with me. I don't do that kind of stuff. It's just not my thing. But in this case, when it comes to blessings, the idea is at a predetermined times, as point the tithing, you come together as a group and you can discuss and share the blessings God's given to us. And of course, the objective of the tithing object, as God explains very, very explicitly, that the purpose of the tithing is to continue to get a blessing next year. That is its function. Is that if you tithe accordingly and share it with the Levite, the proselyte, the orphan, the widow, and such, that is the objective, is to that God will bless you with more the following year, or continue to bless you the following year. If you choose to not share the blessings God's given you, He has no reason to give you any more. Right? If I give you something to share and you don't share it, why would I give you more? I'll give it to somebody else instead, who you were supposed to share with. Basic principle, but that's the idea. So again, obviously, verse 15, it says explicitly that the reason for the sharing of the tithing is that may God gaze down from your holy abode from the heavens and bless your people Israel and the ground that you gave us as you swore to our forefathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. So the objective, of course, that God will look down, see that you're sharing it, and then bless you with more. Let's see here. It's jump down to verse. Look at chapter 27. So I'm going to skip the certain details. We can move on a little bit. So chapter 27, go down to verse 3, the inscription of the words. So 27, of course, discusses about the whole pillars, these rocks, they're great stones, coat of plaster, and they wind up getting put upon Mount Ebal. And you can debate what this necessarily looks like. I can't say the exact size of them or what all was written on the pillars. And they had to be fairly large, huge structures to write the entire Torah on them. So I don't think the entire Torah, although Jewish tradition states the entire Torah was written in 70 different languages on these pillars. I personally doubt that. I don't think you can write small enough to get 70 languages of the entire Torah written out on 12 stones, with 12 stones of pillars. They'd have to be the size of, like, you know, a book and pages. You couldn't do it. But that's just tradition. So in my opinion, this is Daniel H's opinion, don't have to agree with me, that it's my opinion, that most likely the stuff written on the pillars were the curses and blessings written on the pillars, or possibly the Ten Commandments themselves written on the pillars. I'm not positive. Because it is not explicit enough to identify what all was written on them. By the way, they're written on them. They were erected on Mount Ebal. Ebal, as those you are probably fully aware of by now over the years, is a desolate, empty mountain. Nothing grows there except a couple of flowers, and it's really only a couple. Like, probably grab a handful of them, and that's all that's there. It's a dead rock. It's just how it is. It's a dead rock. Well, rocks. It's like a crumbly kind of rock type of place. And so there's not much that grows there. So he commanded, however, that you will coat, obviously, these stones on there. You will also build an altar on Mount Ebal. Ebal was traditionally used as a cursing mountain because nothing grows on it. But yet, right across the valley is Mount Gerizim, a lush green garden-like mountain that has an abundance of everything that grows in excess. And so Ebal being a disgrace and Gerizim being a blessing, most pagan groups seem to have gravitated toward the blessing, the Gerizim, making their altars up there and avoided Mount Ebal. However, God commanded you will build his altar on Mount Ebal. Why would God want his altar placed on a desolate, rocky terrain where there is nothing that grows, compared to the human tradition, human philosophy of putting God's altar in a great big garden setting with fruits and vegetables and trees all over the place that'd be luscious and enjoyable, nice deep breath, and a great beautiful setting. We all gravitate towards a great beautiful setting. But God said, no, don't put my altar there. Because he's not people. He's not a person. doesn't think like we do. He wanted his altar of made of rocks, no cut stone, just round or oblong shaped rocks piled up, uncut, not pretty, just uncut. Left their altar done that way. And they excavated the altars. They found that, yeah, Israel did in fact build an altar on a ball. It was fairly good sized with a very long ramp that led up to it in order to get the animals up there, and made of just random rocks, uncut stone. So they did it. They put it on the altar on Mount Ebal, as well as the stones on Mount Ebal, all to be the curses or blessings, if that's what's written on the stones, or kind of whatever else written on them. I can't explain all that was written on them because it's a little bit unclear. Anyway, they're all put on Mount Ebal, the desolate rock, versus Mount Gerizim, the pretty one. The pretty one's on the other side of the valley, which they could all see. It's a short, small valley. It's in between, it's Shechem's between it. Relatively small valley. You can almost shout across the valley to the one to hear. God said, don't put me with Gerizim. I don't want to be there. That's not a blessing in God's viewpoint. And why is that? Why is Mount Gerizim, why is a great, lush, pretty, garden-y type place not a blessing where God would want to be? Why would he choose a desolate place instead? Any thoughts? Think about it. What would be a good blessing? Go ahead, Adrian, your hands up.
Because if they had worshipped other gods on Mount Gerizim, he would not want to be worshipped there.
That's a fair assessment. If it is a contaminated place, he would not want to be associated with contaminated places because it's trash. Would you wish to be worshipped in a sewer? Not really. You wouldn't want your dwelling in a sewer, would you? So in some ways, that's a fair assessment. Is it a garbage place?
The other thing is that your focus would be, when there's nothing else around, your focus would be only on God and his altar and not all the other things around there.
That is also a great example, Pat. That is also a good big component. When there's nothing else to look at, your attention is not distracted amongst the things around you. So I have to ask myself also the same principle. So Israel, God led them through a wilderness desert for 40 years. He didn't lead them through a lush green valley for 40 years. A rocky desert that gets maybe an inch of rain every other year. It's nothing. Yet that's where he said, I'm going to put you here. God seems to gravitate toward the place that humans hate. He seems to bring you to places where we don't want to be. That's probably a really good reason why. Yeah, here's a good example. Jeff has put up on your screens the picture of Gerizim versus Ebal. So Gerizim on your foreground, Ebal is the background. Grant, this is a modern day picture at the time. So the documentation we have, Gerizim used to have trees on it, and they see it just as some grass. So humans have destroyed it over the years. But Ebal is an empty rock place versus there's green on Gerizim. So there are some bushes, some trees still around. But it's been a while over the past few thousand years. The towns have changed, the cities have changed. But still, the rockiness, the desolate place is where God appears to do his best work with us.
Well, if you also think about it though too, if you are living in the valley and you're looking up in the mountains, and if back then Gerizim was full of trees, God's temple would have been obscured. God's temple or God's this monument would have been obscured by all those trees.
Seen it. That's possible too.
It was largely desolate. That memorial or that altar would have been easily visible from the valley floor.
And based on their excavations, the artist's drawing of what the excavation looked like on Mount Ebal, it was a fairly good size altar.
Yeah.
They made a fairly big structure as far as what they put up there. Is that the ramp went up, the ramp was almost 300 feet long, foot long ramp, to slowly gravel, go up, because you're battling both the slope of the mountain plus the altar to get to. They kind of the ramp went a long distance in order to get there to get up. That it was a pretty good sized altar. They made a big structure out of it, and you could see it for a distance. That was a fair assessment. But yes, Don, go ahead.
Yeah, you might. This might be perhaps far-fetched, but I would say that's a desolate place, and it implies that we as human beings, will, chances are, we'll listen more to what God's trying to say to us if we're in a striving position as opposed to being in a lush, non-striving position, so to speak.
That is awesome. Yep.
I know for myself, and I've said this many times, I know God's talking to me because I just got 2x4 back my back, man. I'll tell you.
Yeah, you're getting beat up a bit. Yeah, like my siblings used to harass some others. My life's falling apart. You must be praying for me again. That's just how it works. There's in our desolateness is when reality is we want blessings, we want to pursue our happiness, things that are good, they're good for us. But reality is when we are covered with blessings and happiness, we have very little use for God. It's just not a big priority. It just isn't. My job's going well, plenty of money, kids are happy, don't fight too much, plenty of food, all those great blessings, things are going great. Let's go golf. Let's go play. Let's go do something that's interesting, fun to do, right? As opposed to, no, let's go actually spend a little time with God and say, okay, God, what can I do to improve? How can I get better than where I am at? Not better stuff, but better as character. How can I improve my life and of existence in His viewpoint? So those, when we are blessed excessively, we tend to completely forget God, as is the common blessings. God, bless me enough to where I do not curse you, but not so much that I forget you. So you want enough to where you don't curse God because you have nothing, or you don't want so much you have so much you completely forget God. So there's a balance in between there. And this course gives us the opportunity in God's viewpoint of the times for blessings come in certain circumstances. And I'm bringing that up because that's the subject matter of the blessings and the cursings. There is activities associated with the cursings that are very distinct. Though it may seem a little bit odd why he has these listed this way or why these are so important compared to other things we don't want to be doing wrong, but these are important because there's a characteristic about them that is important to note. All these curses that we read through already have a particular character about them that is consistent throughout the list. And I don't know if any of you noticed them or not, but we'll go through this real quick and maybe you'll catch what the character trait he's noting. In the cursings list, which is on this list, verse 15 of 27, it goes from 15 through 26. I'm gonna read it all over again, but the curse is the molten image, and you make it and you put it in secret or hide it in a secret place, and that was a curse. Who lowers or degrades his father or mother, it'd be either talking to them directly or about them indirectly on the side, or badmouth them, that kind of thing, or lowers their esteem, that's a curse. One who moves the boundary of his fellow, his neighbor. Now, this isn't you and your neighbor got together, you both said, oh, we should move the boundary. No, you're moving this without your neighbor's knowledge. You're kind of, oh, I'll just move this marker 5 feet that way. Oh, look, I have more land. Oh, too bad for you. You're doing this in a concealed manner so no one else notices. And of course, causing a blind person to go astray. Can the blind person identify you? Maybe if you're really good in his voice, or maybe he can hear your voice if you happen to speak. But when you're guiding someone, he can't see you. He can't identify you. You're misguiding him. He can't see the rock you're running him into. And that blind can be a physical blind individual or someone who's mentally blind, meaning you may mislead someone by misteach them and make them go down a wrong path spiritually, not just physically alone. It perverts a judgment against a proselyte. It means you have a case. Okay, well, you've made a particular way, twisted it in a particular way that rules against somebody who is in a disadvantaged position. And of course, obviously, to lie with his father, the wife of his father, or the sister, or mother-in-law, all the whole list, the sleeping with the animals, or quietly or stealthily strikes his fellow, so no one knows about it, but he did it quietly so no one else could find out. Or pay somebody who received a bribe to kill another person. So again, you paid like a hitman, so to speak, in that capacity. Or not uphold the words of the Torah. In all these curses, there is a common thread. I don't know if you've noticed the thread, but the thread is the quietness of it, the secretiveness of it. See, these curses are listed in a particular way, and they're listed out via the way that, for the most part, no one else will ever know. For example, your father and mother, though you may speak bad of them, they love you. They're not likely to go out and blab the world, "My son said such as about me, what an awful human being." They love you. How many of you love your children? If your children screw up, you don't go broadcast it and turn them into the authorities. "Oh, he's an evil human being." It's just not our instinct. Now, I'm not saying we won't do so. It's just not our instinct to do so. The instinct to say, "Well, if I just talk with them and make them understand better, maybe this will improve." That is in our parental instinct. I just didn't do a good enough job teaching them. I need a better example for them, or explain a better way that they can understand. That's human instinct. The having sexual relations with a sibling or with a mother-in-law or about anybody else, those are quiet, private matters that likely are not going to be broadcast either. Most of these details, in fact, are all quiet things. If I build an image and secretly stash it in, you know, some closet somewhere that no one else knows about, how are you all going to find out? Well, you wouldn't. You wouldn't know. So it was secret things the problem. And he's like, these are accursed because you as a society will not necessarily know when someone does something evil in secret. Secret things are secret on purpose. That's why we call them secrets. It means something is concealed or not known. So these are activities we're discussing, are things that are done in secret. And that's what the problem is. You can't handle, a society cannot correct a secret crime, a secret evil. It's secret. You can't deal with it. So in this instance, it refers to the curses of them, and that you as a society cannot handle the situation. So you're leaving up to God to handle. So people themselves are admitting, okay, we as a group cannot handle these details because we wouldn't know about them. They're not broadcast to us. They are done in the open. So when you do something in secret that is evil, that is wrong in God's eyes, the curse is supposed to be from God upon that individual. So the idea is, when we go across things that we don't know, we can't solve, we're unaware of, that God is responsible for it. We are accepting that higher authority to be responsible to curse or to correct, in a more literal sense, to correct the individual or the individuals responsible for the secret things. Because the secret stuff, I don't know what's in your heart. You don't know what's in mine. Oh yeah, the lifestyle kind of reveals a lot of stuff about us. But reality is, your inner thoughts are still your inner thoughts, and mine are still mine. But those inner activities, you don't know, and I don't know yours. You don't know mine, but God knows them. So you know, these activities, I mentioned before, this is important. Jewish philosophy, thoughts aren't really the problem. It's physical things. So these are physical lists. These aren't thoughts, mind you. These are lists of actual stuff you do. So physical things you do that are done in secret, God will curse you accordingly. Now that is contrast, as we see on Tertullian. The blessings, however, are in open. They're open blessings. They're exposed so all can see them. So the blessings are a beneficial thing, but when you do things in secret, you are cursed. Does that make sense? Hope it makes sense. The idea of the nature of these are all done in secret that only God would know. For the most part, only God would know. Maybe the individual you do it with as well would know. But only God would know about them. So he's the only one who has the ability to correct those mistakes, correct those errors, and make those curses stick. Does that make sense? All right. So, and I don't have time left. I'm not going to get to the half tour, I don't think, but maybe I will. I'm going to jump down to the, let's see here. Next page. The blessings. So the blessings come in a particular pattern. I'm not going to go through the entire pattern, but there's certain details I want to know about the pattern because the pattern is relevant to us modern day. When you're observing God's blessings and his curses, removal of those blessings, note the pattern he chooses. The pattern's relevant because you look around the country you live in, it's mostly the same country. There are a few exceptions. Note the pattern of blessing removal, of curses being put upon you as the pattern is matched. Be aware of what track we are on. Okay? We watch the pattern. So in this case, in 28 discusses the pattern of blessings. It obviously goes through, you bless the city and the field, your children, and then your livestock, and your grain, and your successful coming in and going, all done and open. These are all great things. They are conditional upon a particular thing. So the first few verses of 28, I'm gonna reread them. That's excessive. They turn around, or they give an explanation, is that in verse 9, it says, Jehovah will confirm you with all these blessings as a holy people, if you observe the commandments of Jehovah, your God, and go in his ways. So the condition of blessings requires observance of his commandments and to go in his ways, to walk in them or to follow them. That concept is repeated in verse 13. You should place your head at the tail in 13. It says, if you hearken, this is the latter half of verse 13. If you hearken to the commandments of the Lord your God, I command you today to observe and to perform. So there are conditions that God expects of us to observe, perform, and walk in his ways. To observe, obviously, is the intent to not break or to follow the examples. Perform them are to do things that are positive or good to do in God's eyes. To walk his ways is to pursue that life, that way of life, that existence. So if we fail to do those things, to observe, which means to fail to not break them, and we invite it breaking them, or fail to perform, means we neglect the positive commandments, neglect the good things, and we choose not to walk in his ways, not to follow the route he has taken to us. And that verse 14, if you do not turn to right away from the commandments I command today, to right or left, to follow gods and worship others, if we don't do that, it'd be good. But if we do all those bad things, then of course the curses then follow. I want to point out to you, the curses, some of them are flipped from the blessing side. So he flips them. So in the case I mentioned before, your blessed city in the field and such, the curses are also, as you will occur in verse 16, the curse didn't curse the field. A curse be your fruit basket, your kneading bowl. A curse be your fruit of your womb, the fruit of your ground, the ox of your cattle, the flocks, sheep, and your goats. Stop. So verse 17 and 18 is a flip from verse 4 and verse 5. It means the sequence of events change. So verse 4 and 5, you go back to verse 4 and 5. It says, bless the fruit of your womb, your ground, your offspring, your cattle, your flocks, your sheep, and bless your fruit bowl and kneading basket. But the other, in verse 17, 18, he flips the fruit bowl and kneading basket in front of the curses for the womb and the fruit of your ground. Why is this? Simple. You are blessed in a particular order. You are cursed in a particular order. So in the case of verse 4, your womb and the ground, your animals, also your cattle and the flocks, those grow, those increase, and then you're blessed in your fruit basket and your kneading bowl. So the sequence is blessed in that way. You have children, your children grow up, they increase, your life increases, it expands, more land is cultivated. It's a natural sequence of events. You have more crops, all these things increase, and then of course you can expand and increase your territory, increase your holdings. Well, the reverse happens. Your holdings start shrinking before you start eating your kids, right? Which reality is, if I have many fields of grass or of animals and eating grass, I'm not going to say, "Oh, I'm starving. Eat my children." It doesn't work that way. So your grass, the kneading bowl shrinks. Your fruit shrinks down. You start eating your animals. Then when you run out of everything to eat, then you start eating your kids. Don't worry, children. We're not going to cannibalism. The point is that the sequence goes in that way. So if I look at a cursing versus a blessing, I look at, okay, God, what track am I on? Where am I in the blessing or the cursing? Is my family, are they increasing or are they decreasing? Is my crops increasing or are they decreasing? Is my lot, no, granted, I don't grow crops. But the point is that some people do. The point is that your nation does as well. So if your nation is the holdings, the produce, the fruit, the is that increasing or is it decreasing? Are you on the upswing or on the downswing? So those are thresholds which you will look for. It doesn't stop there. He flips it not only there, he flips it again also later on. And it's also flips verse 7 and 8 was flipped. So it says, let's go back to verse 7 and 8 where he flips it again. And verse 7 and 8 was the blessing side. Said, mind you, the 7 and 8 refers to your government as well as your family. Yehovah will cause your enemies to rise up against you to be struck down before you. This is verse 7. On the road they will afford you, and they will flee seven roads before you when you attack. He will command the blessing for you in your storehouses and your every undertaking. He'll bless you in the land Yehovah gives you. So, of course, that's flipped as well. We continue on verse down to verse. A curse will get me around. It will send you amidst of attrition, confusion, worry, overtaking. Where is it? Verse is that on? Verse 25. You will cause your enemies, you will struck down for your enemies on the road. You will go out against them on the seven roads. You will flee before him. You will cause the terror of kingdoms of the earth, parks, food for everybody on earth. So in the case, we have this sequence of a flip for children and security. So when it comes to a government system, the blessing increases based on security. When you have military attacks, your fundamental concept of government is to secure or create borders to protect your citizenry. And that, of course, gets flipped also from verse 7 and 8. So in the sequence of, we have our most important things that come first, the blessings, and those are the most important things to come first, our children and our security, but they are the last things that are removed. Our children and our security is last removed. So it's the first blessing that comes in, but it's the last one that's removed. So when we have a loss of our children's security, we now know we are in the downswing of the curses. Upswing of curse, because curse is a negative. You're going deeper into the curse category when you start losing your security and your children or your blessings. So we look at our government or any government of the world, when you have a reduction of crops, while you still may have a population, you are in the swing of the curses. If you have a high population, your crops are increasing, you're in the swing of blessings. Both may look the same at any given moment in time. If a population has, 100 million people in it, and it has, enough crops to feed them all, that's it. You might be on the upswing, meaning your crops are increasing, and then actually you have enough to have a surplus. Or you might be on the downswing. Your crops are processed decreasing. Next year, you have a deficit. So when you look or examine not just governments, but also our personal lives, are you in the upswing or the downswing? It might look the same at any given moment in time, the up or down. But are you increasing something or is something decreasing? So it's important to watch. So when you're in a downswing, why are you in the downswing? What's missing? What's failing? What missed that? What opportunity was missed? What failing do we have? Whether it be a personal life or whether it be a government, it makes very little difference. The downswing or upswings, pay attention to them. Blessings, cursings, watch them. That tells you where you're at and what's going on. And then if you see where you're at, then we go, okay, Torah, how do I fix that? I don't want to be in this. Or, yes, good job, Torah. How do I continue on with that? So the idea is watch what's going on about you in your life. Watch the upswing, watch the downswings. They matter. They're not irrelevant. They are not just, random dips. Pay attention to them. Watch what's missing. Okay, if something's missing, something's going down. What's going down? Why is it going down? How do I address this? What am I missing? Is there something I failed to do in God's viewpoint? Something I am continuing to fail to do? What? Now, I'm not arguing that we don't go through trials. That's not the point. I'm not discussing trials. We're discussing blessings and cursings. Are we going up or are we going down? As you look back in your life, the past, and as mentioned, I started out today, where you were at and how you got where you were at and all the years you went through to get there, there were a lot of ups and downs over those years. Some of those ups and downs were self-caused. Some that we caused them, or we made them happen. I wanted this and it fell apart because I was bent on doing just this one thing. That's what I wanted, and it failed or succeeded, whatever it was. those up and down are not irrelevant things. And they are actually meaningful to us. They helped us learn stuff about ourselves, about our families, our needs, our wants, and why they failed or why they succeeded. Those matter. So pay attention to them. I'm not saying you don't. The point is that the idea is we as followers of God are to pay attention to those ups and downs too. Let's, a few minutes left. Let's do a little bit here. Verse 13. Where's verse 13? To go back to verse 13. Oh, right. It shall place, this is a blessing. It place you as a head and not a tail. You should be the source above and you should not be below. The head and tail is a common expression. Obviously, the one who leads versus the one who follows. That's a basic principle. You can be both a head and a tail at any given moment. I can be a head and I can be a tail at the same time at any given moment. I can lead in some areas and I can follow in others. Now, his point here is that if you're the head and not the tail, that means you will lead in all areas and you will follow in none. Does that make sense? The goal is to not be the follower in any area, but rather you lead in all areas. That is the objective as far as a nation or as a parent is concerned. The goal is to lead your children or lead a nation, not to follow your children or follow a nation. Does that make sense? You don't want to be the parent of the children rule you. That doesn't work well. It doesn't end well. So you don't want to be a tail of anything, in particular when you're responsible for those things. So you or I or a nation or people groups can be a head or a tail at any given moment in time. If you are a tail, something's gone wrong. It just has. You don't want to be following. Whether they're following to do good or following to do evil, you don't want to be the tail. You don't want to be the head to do evil either, but you want to be the tail either way. The goal is to be the head that does good. So he said you'll be the head or the tail. Now, later on, he reiterates that, no, you're going to end up being a tail if you go into cursings. You will end up following instead of leading. So it's a balance on our end. We have to watch that. To not necessarily want to be. Now, there are times in our lives, you and I will end up being tails. It's okay. You don't want to stay there, but it's okay. There are times that you will be tails. That's how we learn. We make mistakes. We have to trail on and catch up afterward. We pull up the rear, so to speak. It's not necessarily evil. You just don't want to stay there. As he points out in 28, all the curses and goes through them, there's two of them I want to bring your attention to. So verse 29. So in this instance, this is a various destruction such that God had predicted for cursings. Verse 59, it's an interesting analogy. It says, you will grope at noontime as a blind man gropes in darkness, but you will not succeed on your way. You will only be cheated and robbed all the days. There will be no savior. So does a blind man, well, someone who's completely blind, can he see the difference between dark and light? Theoretically, on his own eyes, he cannot. But there is still a difference to a blind man between dark and night. Darkness versus lightness. In that light or the daylight, when you see daylight, we can see it and there are people up and people are about. When we see a blind man wandering about aimlessly, lost and confused, I can say, oh, hey, Joe Schmuley, here, let me help you. I can take his hand and guide him along his path. So that is a blind man groping in the day. Now, blind man groping at night, he's really about to wander around and there's nobody else to say, hey, Joe Schmuley, let me grab your hand and lead you on the way. There is no one. So a blind man groping in the darkness is actually far worse because there is no one that can save him from his groping because they're all gone too. So you will grope at noontime as a blind man gropes in darkness. it's a phrase that blind man groping in darkness means there's nobody who can save him because it's dark outside. There's no one who can see that can help because they're not around. Does that make sense? So groping at noontime is likened unto that. And also in the tail end verse 29 of that chapter, it discusses the topic of there will be no savior, no messiah, no deliverer. Because a blind man who gropes at dark, there's no one awake who can see that can guide him. Therefore, there will be no one who will help him. No one will help along his way. No one who will guide, get him out of his situation. There will be no one to save him. And you or I would grope about in noontime as such. So when we are in these cursed situations, there is no Messiah. No Savior. No Mashiach. No salvation. Nothing will get you out of it. It's a hard place to be when we envision a scenario which Messiah will not save us. But think about it. There are certain situations where God tells us, no, he won't. We don't like to think about that, but there are certain situations where he says, yeah, I'm not going to save you. You're on your own. Hard place to be. That's the only one I would point out to you. Also in verse 31, a repetition of the same thing. Is your ox slaughtered before your eyes, but you will not eat of it? Your dog will be raw for you, will not return to you. Your flocks will be given to your enemies, and you will have no savior. No one will save you. No one will restore these things to you that you have lost. They're gone forever. Also a hard thing to think about. There are things which you can lose, not just your confusion, but things, in the case your possessions, your livelihood, your dwelling, your hope, your existence, can be removed, and God says, yeah, I'm not going to save it. I'm not going to restore it. It's gone. And there's no savior for it. Again, it's hard to understand, hard to visualize. There are certain circumstances of us abandoning God in such a way where our Messiah says, yeah, you're on your own. I'm done with you. We don't like to think about that, but apparently it's true. If we abandon God enough, our Messiah says, go away. You're dirt. You're dust. Perish on your own. Our God means business. He wants something out of us. He expects it out of us. So I wanted to point that to you. And of course, as it starts going, I'm going to go through the entire thing again. Verse 68, of course, you go, you are so destitute, you sell yourself into slavery, saying, someone please save me and make me a slave. At least I would have something to eat. And he points out verse 68, no one will buy you. You are that worthless. You have cursed and left God in such a fashion that even your labor is worthless. Yes, Jeff.
Puts the parable of the prodigal son in perspective when it's talking about that he realized that he was destitute and all of his friends had left and such. There was someone to go back to. So that was a great message to, you know, the lost sheep of Israel, is that, okay, realize that you've gone away.
So far. Yeah, you've gone away.
And, you know, the father will welcome you back, but you have to turn around.
Right. These curses are when you abandon him. When you abandon him, that's it. He doesn't sit there and say, oh, well, I'll forgive the abandonment. No, it doesn't work that way. You actually have to turn around. You say, I don't want this. I want to go back. That's how you get it. You won't get your ox back. You won't get your donkey back. You won't get the various things you lost back, but those are immaterial. Those really don't matter. You will no longer, however, be a blind man groping in darkness. You will no longer be in darkness. You'll no longer be a blind man, because now you can see. You may not get your ox, your donkey back. Your livelihood's gone. And no one will buy you a slave. But if you turn around, you won't need to be a slave. The whole objective of this is to scare us enough say, hey, I don't want this life. I don't want to live like this. I don't want these destructive things. I don't want them. How do I avoid them? How do I get the blessings?
Yeah, don't play all your country music backwards.
Exactly. Reverse your life. Here's your story. Here's your life in background, in high speed, reverse, in full speed here.
Hey, so, yeah. You get your truck back. You get your dog
everything's
back.
Everything's back. Go backwards. Go where you came from. So, of course, in the verse, we'll conclude 29, because I spent a little too much time on this. I apologize for that. In chapter 29, obviously the miracles you went through, he points out that, I like this statement of God, of Moses. It says, verse 29, it talks about the great things you saw in Egypt, right? Verse 3, I love this statement. But Jehovah did not give you a heart to know or eyes to see or ears to hear until this day. So, and you've went through these great miracles. You went through 40 years of wilderness, but you couldn't comprehend any of it. All the difficulties, all the greatness, all the scary stuff you saw, you still couldn't get it until now. 40 years go by. Now you can look back and say, oh, that's what he was doing. Now I get it. Right. The human condition. We are short-sightedness. We see what was in front of us and nothing we actually went through. So the nature of what was pointed out, it took 40 years for you guys to figure this out. But now you can look back and say, now I get what God was doing, right? Now I can see where the blessings come from. And it explains, which I think this is beautiful. Verse four, I led you for 40 years in the wilderness. Your garment did not wear out from you, nor your shoe did not wear out from your foot. Now stop. I don't know if they noticed the previous 40 years of their clothing not wearing out, their shoes not wearing out. I would hope they did, but if they didn't, because it says your eyes didn't see until now, they look down, oh, look, you're right. I do have the same shoes on. It's been 40 years. I haven't changed. How'd that happen? Or obviously the clothing, yeah, you know what? It smells a little bit, but it's still here. I should wash it more often. But this statement of habit of life says, bread, verse 5, bread you did not eat and wine or intoxicant you did not drink, so that you would know that I am Jehovah, your God. So they didn't eat bread or wine for 40 years. So they think, well, what difference does that make? You don't have to live on bread and wine. Who needs alcohol? Yeah, okay, it may taste good sometimes, but you know, grape juice is fine. No, the point is that you didn't receive these things. What does bread and wine represent? The blessings of the land that you live in. It's the crops, it's the vineyards you grew and the grain you harvested and the bread you made. You didn't have it, you didn't have a land. You didn't have ownership of any of those things. So you didn't have bread and wine. Now think about that for a minute. You survived for 40 years of wilderness without having anything of your own. Imagine you doing that. Let's take you out of your houses. Y'all lose your jobs, no income, go wander in the wilderness for 40 years, have a family, you know, raise them. Let me know how it goes.
See no how it Amazon drone you. Deliveries?
No Amazon drone deliveries. No credit cards. You don't get any of that stuff. Yeah. How do I make ends meet? You don't. You wouldn't survive. And he's pointing out, have you not noticed for 40 years, you had nothing. Yet you still survived. So it should point out to you with your eyes don't see and your ears that didn't hear that your blessings don't come from the land. Your blessings don't come from the clothing you have or your possessions because those weren't relevant for 40 years. What do they come from? They come from your God. Your God supplied you these things. Your possessions and your food are not your blessing. That's the example. These curses and blessings we just went through, a lot of them destroyed your food and your possessions because the curses did. And the blessings were for more food and possessions. But those are not your blessings and cursings. I mean, those are not your sources of them. Those are blessings and cursings of themselves, but they're not the source of them. What's this point here in Treasury 9? Your blessings and are not coming from those things. They came from your God. Did these people plant any grain harvesting equipment? They have any? They didn't plant vineyards in the wilderness for 40 years. They didn't grow crops. Yeah, they still had them. They were provided for. They didn't make their looms. They didn't sit there and you know, the linen stalk flax and let it rot and all the various things and shred it and make and start weaving. None of that stuff. But yet they still had clothing. So your possessions, your food didn't come from the land that normally everybody else gets it from. They came from your God alone. And I'm not sure what point in time in their 40 years they realized this. I hope it was earlier rather than later. But most point out, you didn't see or understand until now. Now God opened your eyes and made you realize where your blessings actually come from. Not from your possessions, not from the land you own. It's from your God. Of course, it was the citation of the people he destroyed as far as the Sihon and Og and the land they inherited. That Reuben and Gad and Manasseh all, of course, would receive this land. And so his tailing parting words on this Torah portion is that you shall observe the words of this covenant so that you will succeed in all that you do. It's important to understand the functionality of these covenants that God has made. This is not the only one in Deuteronomy 29 or 28 and 27. Obviously, there are many covenants throughout the story of our Torah. They're grouped in sections as they go along in the sequence of events. But these covenants add on to each other. So the base of this particular one he's referring to now in this Torah portion is a covenant of obedience, obey, perform, and walk in the commandments of your God. If you do those things, the blessings come. If you don't do those things, the cursings come. So watch in your lives, or my life, or country's life, or nation's life, or family's lives, or group's lives. Are we on the upswing of blessings or the downswing of cursings? And depending on where you are, address it accordingly. Address it immediately. Don't wait. Don't wait until the cursings get really strong or really intense, really powerful, such that we have, you know, terrorists or rioters knocking at our doors. Yeah, okay, you wait too long. Something's gone wrong. You waited a little bit too far. You should have paid attention a little earlier on what's going on. So go back and return where you came from. I'm not saying we are all going to be immune from disaster if that's the case. Because he pointed out you must pray for the country you live in because its peace is your peace. So it is important, not just us as individuals, but us as a people group in our nation, to trust and try to return and call upon our God for blessings to help us out. So we need those blessings. We need those protections. So it's not, we're not isolated. But it's important to know that though we may live in this land, this nation, our nation is not our source of our prosperity. A nation is just a source of our peace, meaning we live in it. But the source of our prosperity, God is. But that is, I'm going to stop there. We'll go ahead and instead of going on to our Haftar portion, our Haftar portion is far nicer. Jeff started reading a little bit earlier, the Isaiah 60 about the blessings, because I didn't do this. Somebody decided it's better to end Torah portions on more positive notes than negative notes. They call it the upswing and make you feel good. You go out and say, yay, I feel good. I suppose I feel down. You don't want to end Torah portions being down. So normally we go to the Haftar Torah portion, in particular Isaiah 60, but I'm out of time to go through that today. But it's a very uplifting one. So I recommend Isaiah 60 as your own personal, help you feel better after this very unpleasant Torah portion. Any comments or questions about this Torah portion that I can answer for you now before we call it quits on this topic? If so, unmute yourself, raise your hand accordingly, whatever we can do, and we can work from there. Yes, Don.
Yeah, it's in verse 5 of 26.
Chapter.
You're talking about Arabia and
yes.
Jacob and Laban. And I understand right. That they made agreements, and one did it in the language that Aramean, and the other one was in the Hebrew language. The question I have is though, doesn't it say in the scripture that Abraham was a Chaldean, and right. wasn't or isn't Chaldeans Arameans?
Okay, so in this instance, the example cited is the now. This is, you can read this. Like I said, there are multiple ways of interpreting the particular Hebrew phrase. The most common way in your English Bible is that my father was a wandering Aramean. In Hebrew Bibles, most commonly rewritten as an Aramean tried to destroy my forefather. Both of them are legitimate translations from Hebrew to English. You see, it could be either one. So if I'm referring to my father was a wandering Aramean, referring to Abraham, well, Abraham, though he went to Egypt temporarily, he did not go down there to sojourn few in number and there become a great nation. Mm-hmm. Who went down to Egypt, few in number, and became a great nation? It wasn't Abraham. No. That would only be Jacob. So in this instance, if you interpret it as Abraham, it doesn't quite fit very well, because down there he did not become a strong, numerous people, and the Egyptians did not mistreat Abraham and afflict him. I mean, obviously they took Sarah temporarily, but that was temporary. And they didn't put hard work upon Abraham or his group. So it fits Jacob correctly in either context, whether a wandering Aramean, because Jacob wandered with Laban for a temporary period of time, or whether you wish to reinterpret it as destroy my father, refer to Laban was planning to kill Jacob. Hence, he came after him with all of his men and soldiers. So he was intending to kill and to take over. So either way, however you interpret it, it is still Jacob in the reference being cited. Now, Chaldean, Abraham. It's an interesting question. Chaldea, I don't, if I recall correctly, the map, the Chaldean territory was not actually part of Amram. Amram, it was a little bit further west than the Chaldean territory. Now, Abraham went through the Aramean territory, including Syria and such, as he was traveling to Israel. But the Aramean would include the Syrians. And Abraham did have a man from Damascus, Eleazar. He was a servant from Damascus, from that territory that was head of his household or in charge of his servants and such. And that he was a Syrian individual, but not Abraham himself. Abraham was further east of the Aramean territory or Aram. However, when he and his father Terah stopped, when they paused in Haran, that was in Aram's territory. So they stopped in the Aramean territory, but he wasn't actually necessarily from there per se. He was born in the Chaldean territory, which is a little bit further toward my east, the right on the map. So he was from further outside and went through. We find out a little more information when Abraham fights against the kings, that they come in and take over Sodom and Gomorrah's territory, and they run off with the captives and take Lot away. Abraham, of course, comes with his men, with I think it's 400 guys or about something like that, and he comes and attacks them at night. And it appears since they were men raised Abraham's household, they were trained by Abraham in how to fight, and they apparently were able to conquer Shelmadar, I think was his name was, who was from Abraham's hometown area. And so there's a good possibility that Abraham may have had a lot of heavy dealings with Amram, but it's hard to say if he was actually an Aramean or Syrian. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. Either way, he had knowledge of them and great awareness of them, able such that he knew their military tactics enough to defeat them. That's pretty good. But I wouldn't necessarily call him Abraham an Aramean or a Syrian. I would, however, argue that Jacob did wander there. But again, I think it's a little bit stretching to call Jacob an Aramean either, in that he wasn't actually from Syria. Hence the idea that hence why the Jewish translate as an Aramean tried to destroy my father, because Jacob wasn't from there either, but Laban was. Laban was born there. Jacob was not born there. He was not raised there. Abram was not born there. He was not raised there. Hence why Judaism interprets or translates that word as an Aramean tried to destroy my father instead of my father was a wandering Aramean. because if it, not, neither Jacob nor Abraham were actually Arameans at all. They were further east in the Chaldean territory. And of course, now I admit you can debate Jacob since because of his mom, Rebecca, because she was Laban's sister. And she would have been classified as Aramean or Syrian. So you can debate Jacob whether he was or wasn't. You can argue and go back and forth on your opinions, and it doesn't really matter. Either way, you wouldn't normally call him an Aramean. That would not be a normal phrase because his dad wasn't. And that's an important distinction. Your lineage in biblical Judaism does not come from your mom. It comes from your dad. Now, in modern Judaism, it comes from your mom, but in biblical Judaism, it comes from your dad. Your dad defines what tribe or what nation you come from. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Hopefully it does. Okay. Yep. Anyway, other comments or questions? I'm way over time, so I apologize for that.
Oh, yeah, Louise. I read the Haftorah in the Living. Can you hear me?
Well, hold on. Children, I can't hear. Sorry, can you repeat that again, Louise?
Yeah. I read the Haftorah in the Living, and it was just wonderful.
The Haftorah is very pleasant. It's a very uplifting Torah portion, or Haftorah portion.
I'm hoping that from now on we can have time to explore the Haftorah a little bit.
I don't always take enough time out of my Torah portion to dedicate to Haftorah. It would be nice if I do that more often. The Haftorah portion, of course, it concludes with that all the return, essentially, of all these blessings of these children, and you return from the nations, returning and expanded extensively to the territory of Israel, be blessed excessively with fruit and with great bounty. And that's the idea that after this great destruction, the cursing that they all experience, when it's done, all the blessings get poured upon as the Torah portion, the blessings pursue you, or they forcefully take you over, the blessings do. And that is a good thing. And I like to point that out. It's an important thing to remember in that I know we throw this catchphrase around for modern day about being privileged. I don't see myself privileged. I'm not a privileged person. I am a blessed person. And there's a big difference in the two of them. For a blessed person is more accurate because although it may make somebody else feel bad, like they're not blessed, but the point is being privileged, I was gifted something because of some unqualified reason, being blessed, God chose to bless me. And the Haftorah portion is great about that. It discusses the blessing God chose to say, okay, time's up. I'm not going to curse anymore. Now I'm going to pour blessings on you, which is a very nice way of ending the Torah portion. So I apologize for not being able to get to that. I wish I did, but I didn't. Any comments or questions? I'll conclude with a prayer then. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you. Thank you for our Shabbat. Thank you for our time with you and with one another. We ask you to bless us, Father, to continue to pursue you wherever it leads. For you are our blessing. You are our source of all things. And we ask you to continue to help us, to instruct us and show us where we are deficient and help us along to improve those deficiencies, Father, and also continue to help us to appreciate, be grateful for the great things we do have, the blessings you have given to us. To be appreciative of them. For we are alive, Father. Help us to remain alive. We ask you to bless us the rest of our time together, our time in this Shabbat. We praise you, Father. We ask your blessings in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.